92 to 95 FM and 810 medium wave, this is BBC Radio Scotland. And now Stark Talk. This week, E.T. is talking to the biggest teen idol of all time. When he was in his 20s, he drew crowds of 40 to 60,000. In 1974, he retired from touring, but now he's back. So, what's he like as a 52-year-old?
I'll never forget the first time I came to Scotland. And I'd been around the world, you know, from Australia to Melbourne Cricket Grounds and all the biggest places, and I came. And I'll never forget the drive from the airport, because I had a private helicopter, actually. And from where the heliport was, the streets were lined with people all the way into town. I'm talking tens of thousands of people just there to watch me go by. And I thought, I've never seen anything like this. It was very moving and unforgettable.
Could it be forever? Was my mind just rambling on? And I touched you once, kissed you once, and now I feel like you're mine. Well, I feel like you're mine, and I see in your face I'm not wrong to have these feelings. I feel like you're mine, I've never known a time before that's had so many meanings. Could it be forever? Or am I just a waste of time? And I don't think so, cause you let me know you make me feel like you're mine. Well, I feel like you're mine, and I can't remember when the feelings have been stronger. All I know is I can't let go. I wanna be with you, wanna be with you, just a little while longer.
David Cassidy, one of the problems about interviewing somebody who's very famous, and they don't come much more famous than you, is that the more famous you are, the more interviewed you get, and the more burnt out you become as an interviewee. So what do you not want me to ask you about?
I'm speaking to you. You and I have never talked before. And if there are things that I don't particularly feel are appropriate, I'll just say, I don't think that's appropriate. But the idea that I'm here and that there are people that are still terribly interested in what I do, my work, my latest CD Then and Now has just gone platinum. All of the concerts have been sold out.
But you don't get tired out talking about yourself.
Oh, I definitely do. I like talking about just about anything else. I love talking about the music and the people that I've been able to work with and the inspiration that I get from my fans. And the shows have been so incredible, remarkable. People have said to me, I've seen concerts for 30 years. I've never seen anything like this. It's really a great compliment.
We're sitting in your hotel. We're recording this before you play to a sell-out audience in Glasgow. Your fans, I'm sure, have changed a lot since they lined the streets before your concert at Shawlands Stadium the 24th of May 1974. They've now got boobs, they've got husbands, they've got children. Do they still scream?
Yeah, they do. They scream and shout and yell. And what's quite incredible is that because I didn't come back, I worked between my concert tour in 85 and the time the last concert here in the UK. Really and truly, I hadn't done a concert here and I hadn't done any work here, but I've done 2,500 theatrical performances and concerts in America. So my audience there is much broader, wider. But even in the last couple of weeks since we've done this tour, there are a lot of younger people that are there. I'm talking like teenagers. Some of them maybe with their moms, I don't know. But because of the success of the latest CD and they've seen me on TV and listened to the stuff on the radio, I guess probably they have suddenly become aware of me and I would hope it would be fans. Now, husbands come along and I make reference sometimes, like, yeah, you got dragged here tonight, but you know what? We're going to rock your socks off, too. So people have said they've, you know, been quite surprised at how I do a lot of what has influenced me from R&B to my, I mean, I play all of my hits, not all of them, but a lot of them. But I went onto my website at davidcassidy.com right before I did my first concert tour in America in 2001, and I asked the fans, what songs do you want to play? And on the website, it goes all over the world. And they chose their top five most requested songs. And interestingly enough, I guess they knew, of course, I would do I Think I Love You and I Woke Up in Love This Morning and, you know.
Dreamer.
Yeah, that was one of the more requested ones. How Can I Be Sure was very, very, and it's probably one of my favorites of my hits. But Cherish was the most requested song by far because I hadn't done it in so long.
You're self-financing this tour. There's no sponsor behind it. There's no record company behind it.
Well, I have a record company that have been very, very supportive. But, you know, I finance all of it myself anyway.
But is that because you now want to be in charge?
I'm totally in charge. I don't have a manager that I really rely upon creatively. I mean, I do have management in terms of my business and so forth and so on.
Because that was a huge problem for you before, wasn't it?
The creative part is the one that I'm always in control of about.
You're driving this time.
Oh, yeah. I make the decisions about all of it.
And from experience?
Well, for the last 12 years, the most successful 12 years of my entire life, I've done it all. It's a tremendous amount of extra work, but if nobody's going to be committed to it like I am and nobody cares, and also, in truth, no one's had the experience, that all of the experience from television, films. You know, I produced two shows in Las Vegas as well as starred in EFX for 2.5 years. I'm still producing a show that's running now in Vegas called The Rat Pack Is Back that I co-wrote with my partner, and we financed that as well.
As you say, you have been spectacularly successful in Las Vegas. It's maybe not something that everybody knows over here, mm-hmm. but you have done a huge amount, great mm-hmm. critical acclaim. Mm-hmm. Thousands of people have come to see
millions.
You were very... Millions.
Truthfully, yeah, like 2.5 million.
So what made you decide that you wanted to hit the road again when it was clearly something which had punished you so much before?
Because I do it now on my own terms, and I do it because the fans have been so unbelievably supportive of me. The amount of fans that have come over from all over the world that have said, please come back, please come to Britain, please come to Australia, which is another place I can't wait to go back. I'd love to be able to go to Europe. It's just really impossible.
But nearly 30 years on then, it does rather look like it really could be forever. Do you know why?
Well, I've always concentrated on doing good work. The work is what it is. It's not about the money or the fame or any of that. You have to do the work. If the work is good, you can sustain if you've got the talent. I've been fortunate because at times when my pop record career wasn't happening, I would go and work in the theater and I'd work in television or I'd go and do something else. So I've been able to sort of, when one wasn't actively happening, and then I would go like I did Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, the original production in 1983 on Broadway, which became a huge success for me. And from that, I ended up coming back over here. I made the Romance album, Last Kiss. It was a top five record. It was a gold album. And then I went and did Time in the West End.
Replacing Cliff Richard.
Right. I did that for a year. And I've always been able to manage to do from one to the next, and songwriting especially has really carried me, I think.
Have you always been proud of your work?
Just about. The work has been the thing that's always driven me. There's work I can look at and say, that's not... I wish I had had the opportunity to, as an actor in particular, to do better. I made a couple of little movies. They were fun and good little movies, but they weren't spectacular movies. And, you know, you just don't have the opportunity. I have never had the opportunity, but a lot perhaps because of my fame, to get the kind of roles I always wanted to. And that's why when I did Blood Brothers in 1993 on Broadway, and we did it for... I actually did it on and off for like 2.5, 3 years.
With your half-brother, Sean.
I did it with my brother, Sean, yeah. And with Petula the whole time, yeah. And it was... I mean, she is so fantastic. And it became spectacularly successful. It really changed my whole life and career more than anything else. The day I closed in the final production I did of Blood Brothers, they flew me in the corporate jet to the MGM in Las Vegas. I moved there and I've lived there for the last 6 years.
That's when you went to do EFX?
EFX, yeah. I did it for 2.5 years.
Did you enjoy that? It was something that you were really taking in to boost the audience numbers, weren't you?
Yeah, it was dying a death. I just reworked.
Michael Crawford had done it before.
Yeah, and it had not worked the way they had anticipated working, and then he got hurt and left, and they'd gone down to 5 shows a week, and within 3 months we were up to 10 shows a week, and then within 6 months it was selling out every single night, and made them a lot of money, made me a lot of money, but more than that, it established me in a way, because I'd never played Vegas. If people ask me what it is that I've been able to do, I think it's that I find a way to get to connect with the audience, which is why when I play buildings that are now 2,500 or 3,500 seats, it's so much more rewarding for me and for the audience, because it's so, I can feel everyone there, and I can feel like I can touch them. I can feel like the energy in the room is so, it's visceral, but I can feel it. When you're playing a 35,000 seat or outdoor arena or stadium, you can't connect with people that are half a mile away.
So it's as good as any drug?
It's better than any drug. It is the drug for me. I love to entertain people.
It was interesting because I read your autobiography, which is now 9 years old, but in it you said that you were doing drugs big time before you were famous and then afterwards.
What I said was that I experimented with drugs when I was a teenager, and in order to get numb, there was a period of time that I would do just about anything just to avoid being in reality, which was so painful. And I've never been a drug addict or an alcoholic. I just was, I'd lost my father and I'd lost my manager, and I was going through a very painful divorce, and it was perhaps the darkest period of my life. And I just, every day I'd wake up, I just didn't want to be alive. And I realized after a while that I was so unhappy that I had to do whatever it took to change that. And I went into analysis, and that changed my life. And I met my wife around the same time, and it was, I mean, it changed my life.
That was 1987.
86, I met her, and I came over in 87, and she joined me, and we did time in the West End, and we began writing songs together.
Tell me about analysis, though, because Scots are actually very poor at accepting that kind of thing. They don't really like looking at their inner spirit, their inner soul. They might mock that transatlantic self-absorption.
Yes, and there's a lot to mock about it. I must add that people in Hollywood, and Woody Allen, as great of an artist as he is, and a filmmaker and a comedian and writer, it has, for me, peeled the layers of the onion so that I can feel again, that I can wake up and love myself and love what I have, my strengths and my weaknesses, and also not make the same mistakes.
That seems so, such an irony, that, though, doesn't it?
The cynicism,
though. Having been loved
though,
by so many millions, you couldn't love yourself.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with my very early childhood and feeling that there was something obviously very deep at an age when my father left my mother at 3.5. I felt abandoned, and I felt like I wasn't good enough. I wasn't deserving. There was something wrong with me. Why would my dad leave? Why would he reject me? Why wouldn't he come and be a part of my life? Of course, when I became old enough to really intellectually understand that, and eventually emotionally understand that he was an alcoholic, and he was manic depressive.
And had also been rejected himself.
Badly. So he had, it was like the hole that could not be filled. He couldn't be loved enough, and he was so self-absorbed and narcissistic. It was all about me, 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 in his case.
And yet people thought Jack Cassidy was a great guy.
He was a great guy. Still, to this day, one of, if not the most incredible human being I've ever met, and it's, there's no one I can compare him to. He had all of the talent that any human being could have been given. He was such a fabulous actor. He had such a great work ethic, too. He taught me a lot about that, the discipline. I think he did 50 Broadway shows. Won a Tony Award. He was nominated for Emmys and got Golden Globes, and you know, he was one of the most respected theatrical actors in America.
Why did he have a nervous breakdown, and why did he drink so much?
Well, because of his own, his father was alcoholic, his mother was a Germanic, cold. She had him when she was 46 years old, which in that time, in the 20s, for a woman to have a child in an Irish Catholic family was very, very wrong. And the day he was brought home from the hospital, he was put on a neighbor's teat. She rejected him from the moment he was born. He said to me once, the only time I can ever remember my mom kissing me was when I was changing a light bulb and I was standing on a table. I must have been 6 or 7 years old. And as I was changing the light bulb, she stood up and kissed me on the cheek. The only time his mother ever kissed him. But he had the wit, he had the humor. He was truly the funniest man that I've ever met. He started working at the Mayflower Hotel when he was 16 years old as an elevator operator. And he would tip all of the bellmen that did every place he stayed. When he became successful and well off, he would go down. It was really terrible because we used to stay at the same hotel, the Sherry Netherlands, where he always stayed. And at the Sherry Netherlands, when I stayed there, I found out that he tipped all of the operators on the phone lines. He went down into the bowels of the hotel, and every time he left and gave them all $20, just because
he wanted to be loved, and he wanted to give,
I guess, some of it back. But yeah, he desperately wanted to be loved.
Before he died, though, you hadn't spoken to him for months.
Now, Nine months.
That's something you can never turn back.
No, and I went through horrible, what I was talking about, part of my real deep depression and sadness was that I wasn't emotionally able to understand his deep, deep wounds.
But you were the child.
Exactly. But if he were alive today, my brothers and I talk about, because they had similar experiences with him. You know, the only one that had, I think, my brother Ryan, my youngest brother Ryan, he's 37 now. When my dad and Shirley had split up and my dad had a nervous breakdown.
And then, Shirley Jones.
Yes.
She
played my mother on the Partridge Family, yeah. She and I were very, very close. And he took her fame. It was difficult for him because he was always in her shadow, Mr. Shirley Jones.
And then, of course, David Cassidy's dad.
Once he became David Cassidy's father, it drove him even more insane because he was the artist. He was the gifted one, and it drove him mad.
But he called you a bubblegum artist at some point, didn't he?
I think it was a lot of jealousy in his case, but I think, I mean, to be fair, a lot of people did.
Did he know, though, that your life was hell? I mean, you weren't really able to have any kind of social life, were you?
He did know, yeah, yeah. He was incapable of really getting outside of himself, though. He lived, narcissists cannot take responsibility for any of their actions. And it's all about them.
So have you managed to avoid narcissism? Because it would be quite remarkable if you had.
I'm not
given
a narcissist.
The amount of,
not at all. Because both my parents were quite narcissistic. My mother was far better than my father. But they were both actors, actresses, and gifted, talented. My mother was arguably one of the most beautiful women that ever lived. She's still, I mean, my stepmother, who is, you know, one of the most beautiful. She won beauty contests before she became, you know, I'm talking about Shirley Jones. I mean, in her day, was considered one of the most beautiful actresses on the screen.
How did your mother handle it all, though? Because people
mistook
Shirley Jones for your real mother.
Right, and understand
what
my mother.
What about Evelyn Ward? Where was she in all of this?
She was very, very frustrated and hurt by it. And I constantly tried to tell people, but when you're there and you're that seeing on television, and I was really close to Shirley, and everyone knew that she was married to my dad, and the press would just say David and his mother, and I had to constantly correct people and make a point of saying my mother, who is also an actress, but because she didn't achieve the kind of success and fame, and really she gave it up to be my mom when I was about 11 or 12, she stopped. And had quite a successful theatrical, she did 35 Broadway shows, both as a singer and a dancer and an actress. She was very good. But again, fate, you know, you can't, success has nothing to do sometimes with talent.
Well, you were, of course, exceptionally successful.
Mm-hmm.
If there's one thing that you could change about what's happened in your life, what would it be?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know that there's one thing I could change. I think we all make mistakes, and if you learn from mistakes, it's taken me all those things to get to where I am now. And if you're a happy person now, then you look upon all of it as been part of the path.
One of your fans died, though.
Oh, I mean, many people that I've loved have died. I wish my father hadn't died, but of course. Fortunately, I had nothing to do with it. It was her last dying wish, really, to go and see me. And I spoke with her parents the next day, and they said the one thing that she always wanted to do was to see you, and God bless you for calling. And, you know, I felt terrible. But, again, she wasn't crushed. She had a heart condition, and she got so excited she died. But the press made me out to be like, you know, they just always like to slag me off, I think, in that respect. They don't anymore because they know that I'm not the kind of person that doesn't appreciate everything I have. And when you survive, when you go through the adversity, I think they know. And also, you can't be successful unless you're good. You got to be good. And you got to go out and put everything you got into it.
Would you trade in that for you?
I wouldn't trade anything right now. The shows I do now, the work I do now, I'm more proud of than any time in my past. And the last decade has been by far. Personally, I have the most fantastic wife and son, and I'm a blessed guy.
You met your wife 13 years before mm-hmm. you got together again.
Yep.
In fact, you had stood up the Queen the day that you met her, is that correct?
That is correct. I broke off lunch with the Queen to have lunch with my wife. At the time, it was just a girl that I had met and really, really liked. And she was an American. She was signed to the same label I was, which was Belle, that became Arista.
She's Sue Schifrin.
Mm-hmm. She is Sue Schifrin, was Sue Schifrin. She's now Sue Schifrin Cassidy. Yeah. Has been with me for 16 years. We've been together. So she became a very successful songwriter, wrote hits for Tina Turner, Olivia Newton-John, Cliff Richard, I mean, all kinds of artists.
But she was a David Cassidy fan.
No, she wasn't at all. Wasn't at all. She didn't even know. When she first came and saw me at Wembley, there were thousands of people. She thought, what's this all about? And, you know, she made her trade and living for 20 years as a songwriter, exclusively, really.
You now have your own children.
Yes.
Given your own damaged childhood, what do you want for Katie, who doesn't live with you? She's from another relationship.
Right.
And for your son, Bo, who is with you and Sue.
What do I want for them? I want them to get a good education. And I want them to feel nourished. And I can only give as much as I can give. And because my son lives with me and Katie lives with her mom and her sisters and her dad, I don't see her very often, but her mother's done a great job raising her, I think. And she's a beautiful girl. I hope she does the right thing. I don't have the kind of parental guidance or input that I have with my son, Beau. But ultimately, I don't care what they choose to do. I just want them to be happy.
Is this a story? I mean, you have encountered the rough as well as the smooth.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, well, everybody has their own adversity to deal with in their lives. It's how one learns from the mistakes that you make and the character, ultimately, of how you treat the people and how ultimately you feel about yourself. If you're filled with hatred for yourself, you're going to be an ugly, hateful person. I really genuinely like people. I always have. I've tried to be as real and honest. And I was taught by my grandparents as well as my mom. And my dad, in some respects, because he treated everybody the same, whether it was the president of Universal or if it was the elevator operator, doesn't matter to me, which is why probably I've never been forgiven by the Queen and her staff and never been invited back for lunch. But I have a great respect for human beings and human compassion. I try and do a lot of charity work, especially for children. My wife has started and basically dedicated the last 2 years of her life to her own charity organization and has never taken a penny. It's called kidscharities.org. Go on and see the website and you'll see the kind of great work she does. And I try and help her and support her. In a way, it's ecstatic for me to be doing what I'm doing and to have the kind of success I never imagined it would last 32 years I've been professional. I can't tell you how much I have loved being back in Scotland.
David Cassidy, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. God bless.
How can I be sure? Constantly changing, how can I be sure where I stand with you? Whenever I'm away from you, my alibi is telling people I don't care. Upside down, it's a pain. I can't seem to find someone who's out.